I want to talk now about November 9th and November 10th, which has been known as Kristallnacht or the Night of the Broken Glass, and how that affected me and my family. And I think what I'm going to say probably can be more or less duplicated as having happened all over Germany and Austria at that time. Austria had already been annexed to Germany. I remember the night on a Wednesday night, which was, I think, November 9th, if I'm not mistaken, 1938. Before I went to bed, my father said to me, if you hear some strange noises during the night, immediately get out of bed and go out and sit and get into the wardrobe in the hallway. And I said, what are you talking about? Why? What kind of noise? And he said, don't ask any questions. Just do as you're told, which was totally unlike my father or unlike my parents. I was always encouraged to ask questions and received answers. If I didn't receive direct answers, I was encouraged to find the answers. But here I'm told, don't ask questions, just do as you're told. And so I went to bed and probably laid in bed for quite a while before I was able to sleep, listening for something I didn't know what to listen for, and finally fell asleep and got up the next morning and forgot all about it, and got ready to go to school and left for school at 10 minutes after 7, just like I did every other day, with my bicycle, together with this one other Jewish child who was at the school, who was also from Kippenheim. And as we approached the school, we had to pass a house where a Jewish dentist had his home and his practice. And I noticed that every window in that building was broken. Now, I'd seen a broken window here or there, but here was a whole row of broken windows. And though I didn't know why, I assumed it was because he was Jewish. And as we entered the schoolyard and parked our bicycles, I could just sense something is different. But I didn't know what it was, and I was afraid to ask. And so I proceeded on to my classroom, and this young boy proceeded to his classroom. And classes started as normal, as they did every day. And about a half hour later, the principal walked in, and he gave a long talk, which even later that day, I couldn't remember what he actually said. But at some point, while he was talking, he pointed his finger at me, and he said, "Get out, you dirty Jew." And I heard what he said, but I could not believe it. I mean, how could this nice man, this gentleman, this good man whose daughter is one of my classmates, how could he have said that? I must have dreamt this. And so I asked him, please repeat what you said. I'm sorry I didn't hear it. And he not only repeated it, but came over and took me by the elbow and pushed me out the door. And I stood out in the hallway, and all kinds of thoughts were racing through my head. What did I do? Did I not listen? Did I yawn? Did I fall asleep? What did I do? What am I going to tell my parents? And the kinds of searching questions that I was asking myself later on, I've learned, is typical of victims look to themselves for what have I done? Rather than realizing that it's an outside force that has caused them the problem. And as these thoughts were racing through my head and I had no answer for them, the door opened and the children came running out. They were putting on their coats. Some pushed me and others called me a dirty Jew and so on. And they all left. And I had no idea where they were going because there was no field trip planned that day. And I didn't know, now what do? Do I go with them? Do I stay in the hall? Do I go back in the classroom? And I finally decided to go back into the classroom, and I sat at my desk, got out a book, and tried to study. I don't think I had any idea what was in that book. And very shortly afterwards, I heard soft knocking on the door, and the other Jewish boy came in. He had had very much the same experience as I did. And because I was a year older than he came to me for advice. And I said to him, well, you go back to your classroom and you study. I'm studying. And he said, I can't. I'm scared. I want to stay here. And I said, all right, you can stay here, but you have to be quiet because I am studying. But I was being very authoritarian. And he said, well, can I go over there to the window and look out? And I said, yes, go ahead and look out, but you've got to leave me alone now. I need to study. And he was at that window maybe an hour, hour and a half, when he suddenly became very excited. And he said, look, come here. What is this? And I joined him at the window, and we saw men in a row, three in a row, chained to each other, chained to the ones in front of them, chained to the ones behind them, with SS men with whips, hitting them and urging them to walk faster. And though we didn't recognize any of these men, we just assumed that they're Jewish. And with that, we decided, you know, nothing so far today has made a whole lot of sense. We better call home. And I called my mother, and somebody answered the phone and said the phone is no longer working. And I called my father at his business, my aunt, my grandmother, and all those phones were, I got the same answer, the phone is no longer working. And Hans, the young boy, called his mother and I don't know, some other people, and he got the same answer. So with that, we decided we just better go home. Though we were afraid to leave the school, you don't leave at 10:30 in the morning without asking somebody, but there was also was nobody there to ask, or we thought there was nobody there to ask. As I approached my house, I noticed that it looked differently than the way it looked when I left in the morning. We had green shutters on the house, and they were never closed during the daytime. Sometimes at night, in the winter, if it was very cold and very windy, they would be closed, and they were closed. And I ran to the door, and it was locked, and I didn't even know that you could lock the door. And I ran around the back of the house, and that door was locked. I came back around the front, rang the doorbell. I could hear it, but nobody answered. And I wondered, you know, where is my mother? She should be home. And I stood, you know, on the sidewalk in front of the building for a couple of minutes, just trying to understand what seemed. I just wasn't able to comprehend what was going on. When I saw a man walking down the street who any other time, if I found myself on the same side of the street as he, I would have crossed the street because I knew him to be one of the town's worst, or the village's worst, Nazis. But in my desperation that morning, I said to him, do you know where my mother is? And he said, I don't know where the bitch is, but if I find her and she's still alive, I'm going to kill her. Well, with that, I just took off and decided I've got to find my father, my aunt, my grandmother, somebody. And on my way, I had to pass this Jewish hardware store, and all the windows were broken, and there was a crowd of people there reaching in and taking out stuff, laughing and joking, and it was sort of a carnival kind of atmosphere, which I also didn't understand. And as I approached my aunt's house, I could see my mother and my aunt looking out of the second story window. And I wondered, why are they looking out? What are they trying to see? And my mother opened the door, and she looked kind of grotesque. And she was taller and heavy, taller and thinner than my aunt. And she was wearing my aunt's clothes. And we exchanged what had occurred to both of us. And my mother told me that about 10 minutes after I left for school that morning, some Nazis came to the house and arrested my father and took him away. He was still in his pajamas and slippers. They did not give him an opportunity to get dressed or even put a coat on, and it was very cold. And as he was walking out the door, he said to my mother, "Find Hetty and try and stay together." A couple of the Nazis stayed behind, and they broke all the windows. And that's why my mother closed all the shutters. They also did some other vandalism in the house. And then after my mother closed the shutters, she secured the house and ran down the street to my aunt, not realizing that she was still wearing her night clothes. My uncle had also been arrested earlier that morning, though there was no vandalism to their house or any broken windows. The reason they were looking out the window is somehow, and I don't know how or I don't remember how, they learned that all the Jewish men starting with the age of 16 who had been arrested that morning had been taken to the village hall. And you could see village hall in the next block from my aunt's house. And they wanted to see if they were coming out. So I joined them at the window. And it wasn't long after that I found out that we saw people coming out of village hall. And they formed in a group and started to march down the street right past my aunt's house. And in that group was my father and my uncle and many other men that I knew, also many men that I didn't know. And I found out just last year when I was back in Kippenheim who these other men were that I didn't know. Apparently men from the surrounding area were all brought to Kippenheim, and from Kippenheim they all marched together to a railroad station in the neighboring community. But I didn't know that at that time. My mother practically hung me out of that second story window, and she called out to my father, "We have Hetty and we're all together." Whether my father heard me or saw me, we didn't know. But what we saw was exactly what I had described to my mother before: men chained to each other, and with the SS men whipping them, urging them to go faster. And there were men, some men were fully dressed, others were partially dressed, some were in pajamas, like my father. We watched them until they went around the bend in the road and we couldn't see them anymore. And we closed the windows and we just sat there. And very soon after that, we heard loud banging on the door downstairs. And knowing what had happened in our house, we decided to go up in the attic, and there was an old wardrobe up there, and my aunt, my mother, and I hid in that wardrobe. I don't really know how long we were in there. It seemed to me I spent a lifetime in there. And I remember also whispering to my mother, "I want to get out of here." And I don't mean just this wardrobe, but I want to get out of Germany. And the reason I was saying getting out of Germany probably came from the fact that my parents had tried for many, many years to get out of Germany. And it was easy, or relatively easy, to leave Germany because the Nazis wanted to get rid of the Jews. It was difficult to find a place or a country that would receive you. It was difficult, particularly if you didn't have any relatives in those countries or didn't know anybody there. And we didn't. And so, you know, we, although at some point my father found some cousins 10 times removed in Chicago. And I remember he wrote to that cousin asking him to help us to get out of Germany, and if he couldn't, to go to his employer, maybe his employer could do something, and if not, go to the Jewish congregation, or Jewish community, and maybe they could help. And I remember very clearly the letter that this man wrote back to my parents, saying that he was very fortunate that he had a job at that time. It was the Depression in the United States, and he was supporting his elderly mother, and so he couldn't help. He was afraid to go to his employer because he was afraid he might lose his job. And he also did not wish to go to the Jewish community because he didn't want to make a fool of himself. And so, why don't you wait and things will get better? And to this day, when somebody says, you know, it takes time or you've got to wait, it's almost like putting a red cloth in front of a bull. I mean, I get extremely angry. It upsets me tremendously. When there are times when one cannot wait, when one has to act and has to act now. And that was one of those times. I was so traumatized by what happened that day that I would not permit my aunt or my mother out of my sight. If one of us had to go to the bathroom, three of us went to the bathroom. Since we could not really stay in our house with all the broken windows, we decided to stay at my aunt's house, and I did not want to sleep alone, nor did I want to go to bed before my aunt and mother would go to bed. So an extra bed was put in the bedroom, and all three of us slept in the same bedroom. For 2 weeks, there was no information about where the men were, if they were even still alive. And then pre-printed postcards arrived, and the only thing that was in handwriting was to whom it was addressed and from whom it came, and the top part of the postcard, the left side of the postcard, it said, Concentration Camp, Dachau. All the men from this section of Germany where I came from were sent to Dachau. Dachau, by the way, was the very first concentration camp that was built in 1933 by the Nazis. And the pre-printed cards stated what all the do's and don'ts, that you cannot come and visit, that all attempts to try to get the person released are futile, and so on and so forth. Once we knew where my father was and where the other men, because everybody within a day or two received a postcard like that, my mother took it upon herself to visit the Gestapo office, that's the secret Nazi secret police, which was in a community probably 100 kilometers or so, or maybe more, away from Kippenheim. This was in Karlsruhe. And it was very difficult for me to let my mother go, but my mother said, you want your father to come home, don't you? And I'm going to try and see what I can do to facilitate that. So you must let me go. And so she left every morning, early in the morning, by train, and came back in the evening, and came back every day with no information. On the Monday of the fourth week, after the men had been gone, my mother was told that my father would come back that week. However, if he does not come back by Friday, he will never come back because he's dead. Unbeknownst to my mother that day, the first Jewish men arrived back from Dachau in Kippenheim. And we heard about that, and so we visited them. And I was allowed to come along and say hello and how are you? But then I had to leave the room because my mother said, you know, we adults want to talk, and this is not for you, you're still a child. But a lasting impression for me was that each and every man that came back that day and in the ensuing days had his hair completely shaved off, and I had never seen that before. And I it horrified me somehow. It seemed degrading. The next morning, you know, Tuesday morning, we of course went back to our house because that's where my father would naturally come. And the people that had arrived on that Monday arrived early in the morning on a train that came in at about 7 o'clock. And my father did not come home on Tuesday, not on Wednesday, and not on Thursday. And on Friday morning, I think my mother temporarily, partially lost her sanity, because she refused to get out of bed, and she just carried on saying, it's no sense getting up, my husband is dead, I don't want to go on living anymore, I don't ever want to get out of bed, there's no sense to life anymore. And my aunt and I tried to prevail upon her to get up, that it was important that she get up. And I was telling her, you know, my father's coming home today, and you've got to get up. We've got to go over to the house. It's getting late. We've got to go. And she just wouldn't. And so I said to my aunt, please go with me to the house. And she said, I can't leave your mother in the condition she's in. You go by yourself. And I said, no, I'm afraid to go by myself. And just about then, we heard a knock on the door downstairs. And I did something for the first time in 4 weeks on my own. I went to the window and looked out. And I thought I saw my father there and called out to my aunt and my mother, you know, Daddy's home. And my mother said, no, it's the Nazis. It's just a ruse. Let's go back up in the attic and hide in that wardrobe again. But I went downstairs and opened the door. And indeed, it was my father. I expected him to come back in pajamas because that's how he left. But they had given him clothes. And he took off his hat. And I said, oh, my God, they shaved your hair. And I thought, you know, he's my father. He's different. Then I can do this to him. And he was so ashamed, he took that hat and put it back on and pulled it practically all the way down to his chin. And we could hear my mother screaming upstairs, let's go up in the attic, the Nazis are here again. And my father went upstairs, stood next to her bed, and she didn't recognize him. And it took a while before she finally came around to it and realized this is her husband, this is my father. And then, of course, you know, the joy was great that he was back, though somewhat dampened by the fact that my uncle hadn't come back yet, my father's brother. And there was my aunt standing there, and her husband isn't back. But my father had some news about him because he had seen him in Dachau. I noticed that my father's hands were in really bad condition, and I asked him, what's wrong with your hands? And he said, well, you know, it was very cold in Dachau, and I didn't have any gloves, and so I have frostbites on my hand. And also, my job was to go to the kitchen at noon and pick up this big cauldron of hot soup and take it back to the barracks. And some of that hot soup would spill, and so I also got burns on my hand. He says, but it's nothing. It's getting better already, and it will heal. And my mother tried to prevail upon my father to change his clothes, to take a bath, or to at least wash up and get out of these clothes. And he said, no, not now, later. And finally, he admitted that he really was afraid to change clothes or to take these clothes off because he was beaten while he was there, and his body was swollen and sore. And he felt like he was sort of poured into those clothes. And they fit so snugly, he was afraid that it would hurt. And so my mother got a pair of scissors and cut the sleeves on his jacket open and just sort of peeled him out of that jacket. And they then went to the bathroom. And I never saw my father's body, so I don't know how badly it looked. And my mother never told me, and my father never told me. While in the bathroom, he apparently had a mild heart attack. And as I mentioned earlier, Jewish doctors weren't allowed to practice. There weren't any in Kippenheim anyway. And Christian doctors weren't allowed to treat Jews. And but somehow my mother had gotten word to our family doctor, who was a Christian, a Dr. Weber. And every night he came and treated my father until my father was well. The term for people like that has been used, is righteous Christian. And I think Dr. Weber would qualify as a righteous Christian.